Welcome to Grand Rapids Daily. I'm your host, A.
And I'm B. We've got a packed show for you today. But before we get into the news, we need to talk about this weather. It is incredibly muggy out there right now.
It really is. We are currently sitting at 72 degrees, but with humidity at a whopping 89%, it already feels a bit warmer. We're looking at overcast clouds for most of the morning, but temperatures are going to climb fast.
Right. We're expecting a high of 89 degrees by this evening, but the bigger story is what happens when all that heat and moisture collide. The National Weather Service has noted a serious risk for severe storms in southwest Michigan, including right here in the Grand Rapids area.
Exactly. With the July 4th holiday weekend coming up, anyone planning outdoor events really needs to stay alert. Those storms could develop rapidly, so make sure you have a way to get weather warnings and a backup indoor plan if things turn dangerous.
Absolutely. Keep an eye on the sky if you're heading out later today. All right, let's move on to our top local stories.
Our first deep dive today takes us down to the Grand River. The Grand Rapids City Commission has officially approved $20 million in infrastructure funding to pave the way for the new Riverfront Amphitheater. This is a massive milestone for a project that has been talked about for years, and it really signals that the city is all in on transforming that Market Avenue corridor. The vote wasn't without some debate, but ultimately, the commission decided that the long-term economic benefits justify the upfront public investment.
That $20 million is a significant chunk of change, and it's important to understand exactly what it's paying for. This isn't money going toward the stage, the seating, or the sound system. This is purely for the unglamorous but absolutely essential public infrastructure needed to support a 12,000-capacity venue. Specifically, we're talking about $12 million just to relocate a major sanitary sewer interceptor that currently runs right through the middle of the proposed site. It's a massive, complex engineering task because of how close it is to the river.
Right. You can't exactly build a world-class entertainment venue on top of a critical, aging sewer line. The remaining $8 million is earmarked for a new pedestrian bridge and extensive streetscape improvements. The pedestrian bridge is going to be crucial here. When you have 12,000 people leaving a concert at the same time, you need a safe, efficient way to move them across busy roads and connect them to the existing downtown parking ramps and hotels. Without that bridge, the traffic logistics would be a nightmare.
And the logistics are a big part of the pushback we saw at the commission meeting. While the vote passed 5-2, it definitely wasn't unanimous. Some commissioners and several residents during public comment argued that using $20 million from the city's capital improvement fund is a misallocation of resources. The critics argued that this money should be spent on neighborhood-level improvements, things like fixing broken sidewalks, upgrading local parks, and addressing affordable housing, rather than subsidizing the footprint for a mega project.
It's the classic debate over downtown development versus neighborhood investment. The critics make a fair point that $20 million could fund a lot of local park renovations. However, supporters of the project, including the mayor, frame this as a generational catalyst. They point out that this $20 million public investment is unlocking over $100 million in private funding. Grand Action 2.0, the economic development group spearheading the amphitheater, has already raised over $70 million from private donors, including the DeVos family.
Exactly. And the economic impact studies they've presented are pretty staggering. They are projecting that the amphitheater will generate around $15 million in new economic activity for the city every single year. That's money being spent at local bars, restaurants, and hotels by people who are coming to Grand Rapids specifically for a concert. The argument is that this venue will elevate the city's profile, making it a regional destination on par with places that have similar outdoor venues, and ultimately generating more tax revenue to fund those neighborhood projects down the line. And when you compare it to our existing infrastructure, it really fills a gap. We have Van Andel Arena, which holds about 12,000 people and has been a massive success for indoor events, especially in the winter. But in the summer, major touring acts often skip Grand Rapids because we don't have a large-scale outdoor venue. We have Meyer Gardens, which is fantastic, but it caps out at under 2,000 people. This new amphitheater would be essentially an outdoor Van Andel, capable of hosting the biggest summer tours. The timeline is also moving surprisingly fast now that this funding is secured.
Groundbreaking is expected to happen this fall, with an aggressive target completion date of May 2026. That means in less than 2 years, we could be sitting by the Grand River watching a major national act. But before we get there, the city and the developers have to navigate the environmental cleanup of the site, which has a long industrial history, and finalize the relocation of that sewer line without disrupting service.
It's going to be a massive construction zone down there for the next couple of years. And it's worth noting that this amphitheater is just phase one of a much larger vision for the riverfront. There are also plans floating around for an adjacent soccer stadium and extensive residential and commercial developments along the water. If all of this comes to fruition, the Market Avenue corridor is going to be completely unrecognizable by the end of the decade.
It really is a pivotal moment for downtown Grand Rapids. The approval of this $20 million was the final major hurdle for the public side of the equation. Now, the pressure shifts to the developers and the construction teams to deliver on this massive promise. We will definitely be keeping a close eye on the site as the heavy machinery starts rolling in this fall. And we'll keep our listeners updated on any traffic impacts as that sewer relocation gets underway.
Moving on to our second deep dive, we are shifting gears from downtown development to local politics and election integrity. With the August 6th primary rapidly approaching, Kent County election officials are in overdrive preparing for the rollout of early in-person voting. This is a massive logistical undertaking, and it's the first time we'll see this system implemented on a county-wide scale for a major election cycle, since Michigan voters passed Proposal 2 in 2022. For those who might need a refresher, Proposal 2 fundamentally changed how elections are run in Michigan. It constitutionally mandates that voters must have access to 9 consecutive days of early in-person voting for all state and federal elections. While some smaller municipalities tested this out during local elections earlier this year, the August primary is the first true stress test. And Kent County Clerk Lisa Posthumous Lyons has rolled out a strategy that relies on regional voting centers rather than forcing every single township to run their own early voting site. And that regional approach makes a lot of sense when you look at the sheer cost and manpower required. Operating over 200 individual precincts for 9 straight days would bankrupt some of our smaller townships. Instead, the county has partnered with local municipalities to consolidate early voting into 15 regional hubs. This means that if you live in a specific township, you might be voting early at a neighboring city's community center. It pools resources, but it also creates a significant voter education challenge.
That's exactly right. The county is launching a major public awareness campaign, including a $100,000 mailer initiative next week to make sure voters know exactly where their designated early voting center is located. Because if you just show up to your normal polling place on the Saturday before the election, the doors are going to be locked. The early voting sites are strategically spread out so that no voter in Kent County has to drive more than 20 minutes to cast their ballot.
Beyond the logistics of where people will vote, the financial aspect of this mandate is staggering. The state legislature did provide some grant money to help counties adapt, but it fell short of the total cost. Kent County is spending roughly $1.5 million to get the system off the ground. That money is going toward purchasing new, highly secure tabulators, setting up secure ballot storage facilities, and perhaps most importantly, recruiting and training over 400 new election workers. Staffing has been one of the biggest hurdles. Finding poll workers for a single Tuesday is hard enough, but finding people who can commit to consecutive days, including weekends, is incredibly difficult. The county actually had to raise the hourly pay rate to remain competitive and attract enough talent to fully staff these 15 regional centers. And these workers aren't just handing out ballots. They have to be trained on the new electronic poll books that sync in real time across the state.
That real-time syncing is a critical security feature. When you check in at an early voting center, the electronic poll book instantly updates the statewide voter file. This ensures that someone can't vote early on a Friday and then show up at their regular precinct on election day and try to vote again. The system will immediately flag that they've already cast a ballot. It's a robust safeguard, but it relies on uninterrupted internet connectivity at all 15 sites, which is another layer of technical preparation.
And speaking of security, a lot of voters have questions about what happens to their ballot after they slide it into the tabulator during the early voting period. Clerk Lyons has been very transparent about this process. Just like on Election Day, you will feed your paper ballot into the machine yourself. The machine scans it, but it does not tally the results. At the end of each day, those tabulators are locked in secure cages with tamper-evident seals, and they are monitored by 24/7 camera surveillance.
Right. The actual counting of the votes doesn't happen until the polls officially close at 8 p.m. on August 6th. The tabulators simply store the scanned ballot images and the physical paper ballots securely. This strict protocol is designed to prevent any early results from leaking out and influencing voters who haven't cast their ballots yet. It's a delicate balance of maximizing voter access while maintaining absolute security and confidence in the integrity of the election. As for turnout, officials are tempering their expectations for this August primary. Traditionally, primaries have lower turnout anyway, and they are predicting that maybe 5 to 10% of voters will actually utilize the early voting option this time around. But they view this as a crucial dress rehearsal. The real test is going to be the November presidential election, where we could easily see 30 to 40% of Kent County voters choosing to cast their ballots before Election Day.
All right, we've covered a lot of heavy infrastructure and election logistics today. Let's hit a few more local stories real quick before we wrap up the episode.
Sounds good. There is a lot happening around West Michigan this week, so let's get right into the roundup.
First up, some great news for college students and their families. Grand Valley State University's Board of Trustees has voted unanimously to freeze tuition for the upcoming fall semester, keeping the base rate at just over $15,000 for in-state undergraduates.
University officials say this freeze was made possible by increased state appropriations and strong enrollment numbers. In a time when inflation is hitting families hard, keeping higher education costs flat is a major relief for the GVSU community.
In lighter news, the John Ball Zoo has officially welcomed a new resident this week. Wyatt, a 2-year-old endangered red panda, has arrived from a zoo in Tennessee and is already settling into his newly renovated habitat.
Wyatt's transfer is part of the National Species Survival Plan, aimed at boosting the genetics of endangered populations. Zoo officials say he's very active, and visitors can catch a glimpse of him exploring the trees near the front entrance. For those of you commuting on the east side of town, take note. The Michigan Department of Transportation is beginning a $4 million bridge repair project on Interstate 96 over the Thornapple River starting next Monday.
This is going to cause some headaches. MDOT is warning drivers to expect single-lane closures in both directions through late October. If I-96 is part of your daily route, you'll definitely want to budget some extra travel time for the next few months.
And finally, the Grand Rapids Public Library has officially kicked off its annual summer reading program, offering prizes and free events for readers of all ages across its 8 branch locations. The program aims to combat the summer slide in reading skills for kids, but there are adult categories too. You can sign up online or at any branch, track your reading hours, and win everything from local restaurant gift cards to museum passes.
That is going to do it for today's episode of Grand Rapids Daily. Thank you so much for starting your day with us and staying informed on what's happening in our city.
We really appreciate you tuning in. Remember to stay cool out there today and keep an eye on those storm clouds if you have outdoor plans this evening. We will be back tomorrow with more local news. Have a great day, Grand Rapids.